This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC59284, The Killing of Worlds, Succession Book 2, by Scott Westerfeld. Copyright 2003 by Scott Westerfeld. Read by Steve Douglas Craig. This book contains 336 pages on 8 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. Interstellar war escalates between the Risen Empire, RC-59274, and the cyborg Rix. Captain Zai attempts to intercept a Rix battlecruiser. The Emperor plans a nuclear attack as a backup. Meanwhile, Nara Oxum, Zai's true love, uncovers information that could end the Emperor's reign. Some violence and some strong language. 2003. From the Book Jacket. Scott Westerfeld, the acclaimed author of Fine Prey, Polymorph, and Evolution's Darling, reached new heights of excitement in last spring's The Risen Empire and left readers begging for more. Now he comes through with the dazzling payoff in Book 2 of Succession, The Killing of Worlds. Captain Lawrence Zai of the Imperial frigate Lynx is a walking dead man. Unjustly held responsible for the death of the child empress, sister of the immortal emperor, Zai has been sent to fight an unwinnable battle. The Lynx must stop a vastly superior Rix ship from reaching the planet Legius, a suicide mission that will almost certainly end in oblivion for Captain Zai and his crew. On the planet Legius, below, a Rix compound mind, a massive, emergent AI formed from every computer on the planet, has been isolated by the Imperial blockade. But the mind has guided a lone Rix commando, Herd, to the planet's frozen north and will soon order a desperate attempt to seize a polar communications array and break the blockade. Herd is a single warrior against an Imperial army, but moving silently behind her is the intelligence of an entire planet. 10 light years away, Captain Zai's true love, the psychic, some say mad, Senator Nara Oxum, is engaged in a deadly game of political intrigue. From her position on the Emperor's War Council, Senator Oxum must find a way to forestall the Emperor's final solution if the blockade is broken. A nuclear strike to destroy the compound mind, which will also kill millions of Imperial citizens. She suspects that the Emperor has a hidden weakness discovered by the mind, a secret so dangerous to his immortal reign that to prevent its discovery, the Emperor is willing to countenance the ultimate crime, the killing of worlds. With this powerful conclusion to the first story arc of Succession, Scott Westerfeld confirms his stature as one of the leading writers of high space opera. About the author. Scott Westerfeld is a software designer, a composer of music for modern dance whose works have been performed both here and abroad, and the author of 4 previous novels. He lives in New York City and Sydney, Australia. Acknowledgements. This novel is indebted to Will McCarthy's research on programmable matter from his Nature article on the subject to a paper I heard him give at ReaderCon 2001 to his kind vetting of this manuscript. Another debt is owed to Samuel R. Delaney, whose views on the topography of swords and sorcery, expressed in 1984 Selected Letters, gave me the courage to capitalize Emperor. To Justine, with whom I have a genuine and continuing relationship. A note on Imperial measures. One of the many advantages of life under the Imperial apparatus is the easy imposition of consistent standards of infrastructure, communication, and law. For 1,500 years, the measures of the 80 worlds have followed an enviably straightforward scheme. There are 100 seconds in each minute, 100 minutes in an hour, and 10 hours in a day. 1 second is defined as 1/100,000th of a solar day on home. 1 meter is defined as 1/300,000,000th of a light second. 1 gravity is defined as 10 meters per second squared acceleration. The Emperor has decreed that the speed of light shall remain as nature has provided. From the introduction to The Imperial Civil War, compiled by the Academy of Material Detail. 2,000 years ago, it is believed, the population of diasporic humanity surpassed 100 trillion, including various more or less human types in addition to the main germlines. This was a very rough count, and given the scale of the galaxy and the unattainability of translight travel, informed estimates can no longer be made. Certainly, no census is possible. But it is obvious that humanity is a vast object of study even when matters of merely local concern are engaged. The risen empire, with its 80 worlds, its trillions, and its coreward position, dense with neighbors such as the Ricks, the Feshten, and Laxu, is huge enough to seem unaffected by the actions of individuals. Historians speak of social pressures as if they were physical laws, of unstoppable forces of change, of destiny. But for the men and women who walked the historical stage, these forces were often invisible, hidden by their sheer scale and the rank propaganda of the times. Social pressures built invisibly over lifetimes, not across the pages of a history text. And destiny only became apparent after the dice had been thrown. For those who experienced them directly, historical events were ruled by the fortunes of war, the whims of lovers, and dumb luck. Fate arises out of such humble paths as these. In the current era, when the inevitability of the Imperial Civil War is received wisdom, we must work to remember that it was the product of specific events. Collapse would have come in any case, true, but it might have come centuries earlier, or more likely, centuries later than it did. For the generations who lived under the cultural and military tyranny of the risen emperor, the difference was not trivial. The origins of the Civil War are now learned by rote. The risen empire was riven into two parts. The limited democracy of the Senate contested the iron rule of the emperor in an uneasy dance of power sharing. Representative government provided an outlet for popular will, while the imperial cult of personality supplied a patriarch to bind together 80 worlds, the living populace and the risen dead each playing their part in the machinery of the empire. The great majority of imperial citizens were alive and constituted the collective engine of change and economic productivity. As inventors, capitalists and workers, they were the functional, instrumental members of society. The risen dead, on the other hand, represented continuity with the past. They controlled the established wealth, owning the land, the shipping charters, the ancient copyrights, dominating religion and high culture, an undead aristocracy of sorts. These tensions, fundamentally a class conflict, had to find release eventually. The immortal emperor and his fanatical apparatus had held on to power at any cost for centuries, making it almost certain that any resolution would be a bloody one. Adding to this instability, the small gene pool of its founder population made the empire particularly susceptible to mass manias, cults of personality, pandemics, and other forms of radical upheaval. Still, specific events brought about the Civil War in a specific way and are worth historical study. There was a second Rix incursion, a Senator Nara Oxum, a Captain Laurent Zai. The second Rix incursion began on Legis 15. It was at root a religious war. The Rix cult worshipped planetary scale AI, which the Emperor's apparatus jealously stamped out of existence wherever it arose. The Rix viewed this as deicide and planned a deicide of their own, perhaps from the moment the Child Empress retired to Legis. Sister to the Emperor, Anastasia was his only equal as an object of worship. 1600 years earlier, the emperor had worked to save Anastasia's life from a juvenile disease, inventing immortality in the process and forming the basis of the risen empire. Thus, she was known as the Reason, the child for whom the old enemy Death had been defeated. When a small Rix warship penetrated Legis's defenses and took her hostage, the risen empire had suffered a devastating blow. Captain Laurent Zai found himself in the unenviable position of being in command of the only imperial warship in the Legis system. The Lynx was a capable ship, a small, powerful frigate prototype, but any attempt to rescue Anastasia from a squad of Rix commandos could only be a desperate gamble. Under the military conventions of the day, failure would constitute a so-called error of blood, demanding ritual suicide from the commanding officer. There was little time to weigh the issue. Once the Rix had taken the Child Empress, they set loose a compound mind within the Legis infrastructure. Over a few hours, every networked machine on the planet, diaries, market mainframes, pocket phones, traffic computers, was amalgamating into a single emergent consciousness. Alexander. Captain Zai had to act quickly. Given the chaos of the rescue attempt, it will never be clear if the Child Empress was killed by her Rix captors or by the Imperial apparatus. Theories of the Emperor's involvement have never been decisively proven. Easier to confirm is why Laurent Zai refused the blade of error, flying in the face of tradition. Although he was from an ancient and grey military family, sworn to the Emperor's service, he had recently sworn a different sort of loyalty to Nara Oxum, a senator from the anti-imperial secularist party. The two were in secret contact, he at the Rix frontier and she at the capital, throughout the beginning of the Rix war. When she asked Zai not to kill himself, he assented. Love, in this case, was a stronger force than honor. The rescue attempt had come too late for Legius. The Rix compound mind emerged within the planet's infrastructure, an alien intelligence in possession of a hostage world. But Alexander was cut off. The polar facility that maintained Legius's interstellar communications remained in Imperial hands. Alexander was alone, save for a single Rix commando who had survived the rescue attempt. With the help of omnipresent Alexander and her hostage lover, Rana Harta, this Rix woman disappeared to the far north to await the compound mind's next move. On board the Lynx, Captain Lawrence Zai faced a mutiny, an attempt by Grey members of his crew to enforce the error of blood. Though he and his able first officer, Kathary Hobbs, easily thwarted the mutineers, a far more dangerous threat approached. Another Rix ship, a battlecruiser of far greater firepower than Zai's frigate, had entered the Legius system. Although officially pardoned by the Emperor for his error of blood, Zai was ordered to engage the battlecruiser to prevent it from making contact with the compound mind, a suicide mission, the Emperor no doubt assumed. Of course, Lawrence Zai could not have imagined the fate that awaited Legius 15 if the Lynx should fail. The Emperor probably planned a nuclear attack from the moment the Rix mind came into existence. Total annihilation of the Legius infrastructure offered three advantages to the Sovereign. He could destroy the compound mind, rally the Empire behind another costly war with the Rix, and, most importantly, maintain the secret that had underlain his rule for 16 centuries, a secret grasped by Alexander in its first hours of consciousness. Against the objections of Senator Oxum and the anti-imperial parties, the Emperor's hand-picked war council approved the attack by a narrow margin, providing political cover for this desperate act. But Lawrence Zai and the Lynx proved far more resourceful and luckier than anyone might have expected. Prologue. Captain. The Lynx exploded, expanded. The frigate's energy sink manifold spread out, stretching luxuriant across 80 square kilometers. The manifold was part hardware and part field effect. Staggered ranks of tiny machines held in their hexagonal pattern by a lacework of easy gravity. It shimmered in the Legius sun, refracting a mad god's spectrum, unfurling like the feathers of some ghostly translucent peacock seeking to rut. In battle, it could disperse 10,000 gigawatts per second, a giant lace fan burning hot enough to blind naked human eyes at 2,000 clicks. The satellite turrets of the ship's four photon cannon eased away from the primary hull, extending on hypercarbon scaffolds that always recalled to Captain Lawrence Zai the iron bones of ancient cantilever bridges. They were removed on their spindly arms 4 kilometers from the vessel proper, and the Lynx was shielded from the cannon's collateral radiation by 20 centimeters of hull alloy. Using the cannon would afflict the Lynx's crew with only the most treatable of cancers. The four satellite turrets carried sufficient reaction mass and intelligence to operate independently if released in battle. And from the safety of a few thousand kilometers distance, their fusion magazines could be ordered to crash fire, consuming themselves in a chain reaction, delivering one final lethal needle toward the enemy. Of course, the cannon could also be crash fired from their close-in position, destroying their mothership in a blaze of deadly glory. That was one of the frigate's 5 standard methods of self-destruction. The magnetic rail that launched the Lynx's drone complement descended from her belly and telescoped to its full 1,900-meter length. A few large scout drones, a squadron of ramscatters, and a host of sandcasters deployed themselves around the rail. The ramscatters bristled like nervous porcupines with their host of tiny flechettes, each of which carried sufficient fuel to accelerate at 2,000 Gs for almost a second. The sandcasters were bloated with dozens of self-propelled canisters, whose ceramic skins were cross-hatched with fragmentation patterns. At the high relative velocity of this battle, sand would be Zai's most effective weapon against the Rix receiver array. Inside the rail bay, great magazines of other drone types were loaded in a carefully calculated order of battle. Stealth penetrators, broadcast decoys, minesweepers, remotely piloted fighter craft, close-in defense pickets all awaited their moment in battle. Finally, a single dead man drone waited, This drone could be launched even if the frigate lost all power, accelerated by highly directional explosives inside its dedicated backup rail. The dead man was already active, continuously updating its copy of the last 2 hours' log files, which it would attempt to deliver to Imperial forces if the Lynx was destroyed. When we are destroyed, Captain Lawrence Zai corrected himself. His ship was not likely to survive this encounter. It was best to accept that. The Rick's vessel outpowered and outgunned them. Its crew was quicker and more adept, so intimately linked into the battlecruiser's systems that the exact point of division between human and hardware was a subject more for philosophical debate than military consideration. And Rick's boarding commandos were deadly. Faster, hardier, more proficient in compromised gravity. And of course, they were unafraid of death. To the Ricks, lives lost in battle were no more remarkable than a few brain cells sacrificed to a glass of wine. Zai watched his bridge crew work, preparing the newly configured links to resume acceleration. They were in zero-G now, waiting for the restructuring to firm up before subjecting the expanded frigate to the stresses of acceleration. It was a relief to be out of high-G, if only for a few hours. When the engagement started in earnest, the ship would go into evasive mode, the direction and strength of acceleration varying continuously. Next to that chaos, the last 2 weeks of steady high acceleration would seem like a pleasure cruise. Captain Zai wondered if there was any mutiny left in his crew. At least 2 of the conspirators had escaped Hobbs's trap. Were there more? The senior officers must realize that this battle was unwinnable. They understood what a Rick's battlecruiser was capable of and would recognize that the Lynx's battle configuration had been designed to damage its opponent, not preserve itself. Zai and XO Hobbs had optimized the ship's offensive weaponry at the expense of its defenses, orienting its entire arsenal on the task of destroying the Rick's receiver array. Now that the Lynx was at battle stations, even the junior officers would be able to spot the ill portents that surrounded them. The boarding skiffs remained in their storage cells. It was unlikely that Zai's Marines would be crossing the Gulf to capture the Rick's battlecruiser. Boarding actions were the privilege of the winning vessel. Instead, Imperial Marines were taking up positions throughout the Lynx, ready to defend it from capture should the Rick's board the vessel after pounding it into helplessness. Normally, under these conditions, Zai would have issued sidearms to the crew to help repel boarders. But after the mutiny, this seemed a risky show of faith. Most ominously, for any crewman who chose to notice, the singularity generator, the most dramatic of Zai's self-destruct options, was already charged to maximum. If the Lynx could draw close enough to the enemy battlecruiser, the two craft would share a dramatic death. In short, the Lynx was primed like an angry blind drunk hurtling into a bar fight with gritted teeth, fairly anxious to inflict damage, unconscious of any pain she might feel herself. Perhaps that was their one advantage in this fight, Zai thought. Desperation. Would the Ricks try to protect the vulnerable receiver array? Their mission was obviously to communicate with the compound mind on Legis, but would the dictates of saving the array force the Ricks' commander to make a bad move? If so, there might be some slim hope of surviving this battle. Zai sighed and grimly pushed this line of thought aside. Hope was not his ally, he had learned over the last 10 days. He turned his mind back to the bridge airscreen and its detailed schematic of the Lynx's internal structure. The wireframe lines shifted like a puzzle box, as walls and bulkheads inside the frigate slid into battle configuration. Common rooms and mess halls disappeared to make space for expanded gunnery stations. Passageways widened for easier movement of emergency repair teams. Crew bunks transformed into burn beds. The sickbay irised open, consuming the zero-G courts and running tracks that usually surrounded it. Walls sprouted handholds in case of gravity loss, and everything that might come loose in sudden acceleration was stowed, velcroed, bolted down, or simply recycled. Finally, the coiling, shifting, expanding, and extruding all came to a halt, and the schematic eased into a stable shape. Like a well-crafted mechanical bolt smoothly locking into place, the vessel became battle-ready. A single klaxon sounded. A few of his bridge crew half-turned towards Zai. Their faces were expectant and excited, ready to begin this fight regardless of the ship's chances. He saw it most in Cathery Hobbs's expression. They'd been beaten back on Legis 15, all of them, and this was their chance to get revenge. The mutiny, however small and aborted, had shamed them as well. They were ready to fight, and their bloodlust, however desperate, was good to see. It was just possible, Lawrence Zai allowed himself to think, that they would get home. The captain nodded to the first pilot, and weight gradually returned, pressing him into the shipmaster's chair as the frigate accelerated. The Lynx moved toward battle. One. Space battle. The initial conditions of a battle are the only factors that a general can truly affect. Once blood is drawn, command is merely an illusion. Anonymous 167. Militia worker. The contrail of a supersonic aircraft blossomed weakly in the thin, dry air, barely marking the sky. Rana Harter imagined the passengers far above, reclining in sculpted, crash-safe chairs, the air they breathed scented with some perfumed disinfectant, perhaps being served some light snack now midway to their destination. From up there, other contrails would be visible through windows of transparent hypercarbon. Most long-haul air routes on Legius passed over the pole. The continents were clustered in the northern hemisphere, far from the raging equatorial sea and the vast silent ocean of the south. Air transit routes converged here at the pole like the lines on a dribble hoop ball, this tundral waste and empty junction overflown but never visited. Rana had never traveled on an aircraft before Herd had brought her here. She could only blurrily imagine airborne luxury, the gaps in her vision filled with the sound of wealthy people's music, soft strings repeating the same slow phrase. She watched the wind move drift snow across the plain and noted the direction and speed of the few scudding clouds. Her brain bug made a prediction. The contrail reached a certain point, and Rana said, "Now." At that moment, the contrail jagged suddenly, a sharp angle marring its slow curve. A few pieces of detritus caught the sun, flickering with their spin, falling from the supersonic craft with the apparent slow motion of great distance. The plane quickly recovered, righting its course. Rana imagined the sudden, sickening lurch inside the cabin. Glasses of champagne flying, trays and hand luggage upset, every object leaping toward the ceiling as the plane lost 1,000 meters of altitude in a few seconds. The unexpected opening of the cargo hold would instantly double the plane's drag profile, sending a shock through the entire craft. Hopefully, the smart seats would hold their passengers in. A few bloodied noses and wrenched shoulders, perhaps a concussion for some unlucky soul on her feet. But by now, the plane had righted itself, automatically closing the offending cargo door. Rana Harter had discovered that her brain bug worked better if she indulged these fancies. As she imagined the sudden jolt above, her eyes tracked the flickering fall of luggage and supplies, and she felt the whirring of her mind as it calculated the location and shape of the debris field. The sharp, determinate mass of trajectories and wind smelled like camphor, rang in her ears with vibrato-free, pointillistic notes on a handful of flutes, one for each variable. The answers came. She turned to Herd, already dressed in her hooded fur coat. The sable had come from the first luggage drop arranged by Alexander. The stain that had once disguised Herd's Rick's eyes was faded now, and they shone in their true violet, beautiful in the frame of black fur. The hairs of the coat ruffled in the bitter wind, a fluttering motion that made Rana hear the small shimmering bells worn by wedding dancers on their feet. Herd awaited her instructions, always respectfully silent when Rana's ability was in use. Though the commando had squeezed her hand as her word now seemed to yank the airplane from its path. 74 clicks that way, Rana said, pointing carefully. Herd's violet eyes followed the line of the gesture, checking for landmarks. Then she nodded and turned to Rana to kiss her goodbye. The Rickswoman's lips were always cold now, her body temperature adapted to its environment. Her saliva tasted vaguely of rust, like the iron tang of blood, but sweeter. Her sweat contained no salt, its mineral content making it taste like water from a quarry town. As Herd dashed toward the flyer, the oversized coat lifting into sable wings, the synesthetic smell of the commando's avian lemongrass movements mingled with the flavor left in Rana's mouth. The joy of watching Herd never lessened. Rana turned back toward the cave entrance before the recon flyer whined to life, however. Every second here in the cold was taking something out of her. Inside, it was above freezing. Rana Harter wore 2 layers of real silk, a hat of red fox, and her own fur coat, vat-grown chinchilla lined with blue whale from the ubiquitous herds of the southern ocean. But she was still cold. The walls of the cave were hung with centuries-old tapestries earmarked for the Museum of Antiquities in Poleaxe. A vast collection of toiletries and clothing, the bounty of fallen personal luggage, lined the icy shelves Herd had carved into the walls. Rana and Herd slept on the pelt of a large ursoid creature that neither of them recognized. A customs stamp confirmed its off-world origins. The floors were covered with soft linings ripped from luggage, a pile of undergarments forming an insulating layer underneath. The small, efficient machines of travel were everywhere. Handheld games and coffee pots, flashlights and sex toys. All for Herd to dissect and rebuild into new devices. For sustenance, they had only prestige foods. Rich meats from young animals, fruits scandalously out of season, caviar and exotic nuts, candied insects and edible flowers. It all came in morsel sizes suitable for luxury airplane meals. Canned, self-heating and freeze-dried, bagged and cold-boxed. To be washed down with liquor in plastic bottles dwarfish enough to have survived the long fall. They drank from two crystal glasses that someone thought valuable enough to pack in 30 centimeters of smart foam. Oddly, the glasses had been labeled as coffee beans on their packaging. A mistake, or perhaps they were smuggled antiques. All this bounty from only 3 aircraft holds, Rana wondered. She had never seen such wealth before. She lifted a smart plastic tennis racket, its rim no wider than the strings it suspended, and wondered at the instrument's elegant, almost Rixian lines. This fourth luggage accident would be their last haul. The background rate of such events had already been wildly exceeded, and Alexander's false clues explaining the cargo door defect had begun to wear thin. But she and Herd had all they needed until the compound mind called them to action. Until then, they would live in luxury, and they had each other. Rana Harta sat and rested from the freezing minutes outside. She lifted up a travel handheld to read, and that simple exertion tired her. She slept longer each night, dreaming lucidly but abstractly in the strange symbols of her brain bug. Her happiness never wavered, though. The dopamine regulators saw to that. The infection in Rana's wound was gone, disappearing in a single fevered night after an ampule of nanos from Herd's medical kit. But the weight in Rana's chest was still there, building and building. Her breath grew shorter by the day. She activated the travel handheld. Its screen lit up, bookmarked to its medical compendium. Rana flicked it off again. She had read this section enough times and knew that her one good lung was slowly going. Fluids were slowly building up in the wall between ribcage and lung, squeezing the breath from her like a tightening fist. Only an operation could save her. However resourceful her Rick's lover might be, surgery was beyond their means here in this icy cave. Rana Harta's mind had never possessed a sharp sense of irony. The mean circumstances of her life had never required one, but she saw the joke here. She was surrounded by everything she had ever desired. Every petty luxury and marker of wealth. An invisible god that she positively knew to exist. Free use of her brain bug in a safe retreat at the literal end of the earth. And a lover of alien beauty, a fierce and lethal protector whose physical grace, novel mind, and violet eyes offered whole new worlds of fascination. And the punchline? Rana, in the next few days, would almost certainly die. She turned from these thoughts the way a child ignores a light rain. They did nothing to reduce her joy. Whatever occurred, she, one of the few among humanity's trillions, had chanced blindly into happiness. Death must have found me, Rana Harta decided. She was already in heaven. Senator. Nara Oxum took firm hold of the handrail before purging the drug from her system. The balcony barely swung in the cool late-night wind, its motion held in check by counterweights rolling inside the wooden deck beneath her bare feet. A set of finger-width polyfilaments reinforced the softly creaking ornamental chains. With enough tensile strength, the building propaganda bragged, to hold an African elephant, even during one of the Coriolis squalls that sometimes reached the capital in late summer. If Senator Oxum were to slip and fall, she would only become entangled in the invisible suicide mesh that cocooned the entire building and be delivered back to the nearest observation deck 5 floors below. And in case of the unthinkable, the balcony carried a small vacuum blimp compressed under the breakfast table. When fully deployed, it would provide enough lift to bring the senator and approximately 20 guests down to a soft landing. but the animal mind was strong in humans, as Nara's